Welcome to Econoday's Weekly Economists Roundtable. Our conversations revolve around what has happened in the past week and what we expect to happen going forward. I am Ann Picker, Econoday's Chief Economist. Also participating are Jeremy Hawkins, our man in London who covers Europe and the UK, and Mark Pender, our man in the Poconos who covers the US. Why don't you start, Mark?
Okay, we'll start off with last week, and we had a low reading on GDP, 0.7% for the fourth quarter. Consumer was strong, or not quite strong, but it held up pretty well. The weakness was in exports, and then we saw that yesterday with the ISM, and it's now stuck below 50, even though the factory sector has really kind of been below 50 for the whole last year. The ISM has a special, I think, psychological impact. It is really the first of those PMIs which now have burst over the globe over the last few years, the ISM, going back through its history, nearly 100 years. So it has a lot of focus, and that's a warning sign. Coming up on Friday, we have the jobs report where the Econoday consensus for non-farm payroll is 188,000. That is a pretty respectable level, almost 100,000 over what Janet Yellen calls enough to replace, have new people coming into the workforce. However, it's way down from December at 292,000 and the three-month average, which is really shockingly high at 284,000. So slowing seems to be the story, and it is of course centered in the manufacturing sector, and we saw that yesterday with personal income and consumption expenditures, where the pay data for manufacturing isn't looking very good at all, in contrast to the service sector, which is slow and steady and really the core of the U.S. economy and really maybe the hope for the global economy as well. If the U.S. consumer can hang in there with enough job growth, they may be able to start buying enough foreign goods and maybe lift everybody out of what looks to be a slowdown. The FOMC was also last week, and that was a very dovish statement, citing all the troubles bringing out the global risk and also the financial stress that we're seeing, and we continue to see. Today we're seeing it again. We're getting, as Jeremy had predicted, by the way, that we have a rush into U.S. Treasuries, but it isn't sinking the dollar yet, but interest rates are really coming down very sharply. It's all has a deflationary feel to me. But still, I mean, we're going to get this. One thing on the jobless, on the job report, I want to note is the reason the forecasts have come down so much is because of a rise in jobless claims, both initial and continuing. And that reflects more layoffs and longer time being laid off. But still, they're very, very low. And the economy is very close to full employment right now. So I guess that's the positive, even though we may have to get used to less positive numbers and also, the financial stress in the markets. I think that's it for my end.
I should add, Mark, that last night, U.S. Eastern Time, the Reserve Bank of Australia also highlighted international events and slowing in the global economy in their statement. They didn't change their rate, though. They kept their 2% interest rate.
Well, that was the thing. You know, the Fed had raised its rate, and now that's not looking like such a smart move, especially, in the markets now it completely priced out where we're supposed to be four incremental rate hikes through the year. So everything is up in the air due to the slowness, but still the U.S. economy is hanging in there.
Yeah, should talk about the Bank of Japan. Last Friday, Japan time, the Bank of Japan shocked watchers in the markets when it said it would cut its benchmark interest rate below zero to minus 0.1% in an attempt to counteract the effects of falling oil prices and China's slowdown. It should be noted that the move, however, is not quite as dramatic as it sounds. The new negative rate will apply only to new reserves that banks park at the BOJ. Existing reserves, which now total a record 220 trillion yen will continue at 0.1%. That yen figure translates to $1.8 trillion, by the way.
Well, you know, we haven't had negative rates here, but Jeremy, Europe is loaded with negative rates.
Yeah, that they're at 0.3%. We think that the officials at the bank, given that the vote to move to negative rates was 5-4 on the Monetary Policy Board, that quantitative easing may soon approach a natural limit as the ready supply of government bonds dwindle. The BOJ's balance sheet, as a frame of reference, which kind of boggles my mind, has swollen to 75% of GDP. So the relative adoption, the adoption of a relatively weak negative rate probably indicates a desire to test the waters and the market's reaction before slumping down further into negative territory. There was a one-day wonder rally as the equity markets globally celebrated the news on Friday. However, over the weekend, obviously, some people had second thoughts. And yesterday, Europe and U.S. equities were down, while Asia was mixed. And today, it looks like it's going to be a completely negative day, with the exception of China, which for some reason was up. Jeremy?
Okay, thanks, Anne. Well, welcome from a sunny London. Well, at least say the weather's looking good, but that's more than can be said for the data at the moment. Really just following on from what Anne and Mark have been saying, it's a fairly dismal story over here at the moment. Before I touch on Europe, I suppose I should perhaps just quickly mention India. We had the RBI meeting taking place earlier on today. They came out, and to no one's real surprise, they left interest rates on hold. So their principal benchmark repo rate at 6.75%. But it's interesting to note just how dovish the tone of the accompanying statement was. And it kind of suggested that if they had been able to, the central bank might well have come out and cut interest rates there too. Now, the fact that they didn't probably says as much as anything else about the performance of the currency markets and the fact that we've still got this underlying pressure on most of the emerging markets for the time being at least. But the other point to say about that is that, you know, really India is supposed to be one of the better performing currencies of that group in the sense that it's not so commodity based, there's more high tech going on out there. So really expect that to, if anything, outperform, but we're not seeing that. And it really does, I suppose, just highlight this general sense of risk aversion. And as we keep on talking about these roundtables, the degree of uncertainty surrounding the investor community pretty well everywhere at the moment. Okay, with that in mind then, with regards to Europe, well, more of the same really. In terms of the main economic data, the economic sentiment index for January hit a 5-month low. Within that, we saw fresh falls in two of the three main price expectations components. That's going to be leapt on by financial markets as giving more justification for an increasingly expected cut, or at least increasing quantitative easing, whatever it may be, from the ECB in March. Inflation actually moved a touch higher on the harmonized index consumer prices in January, but that was simply a reflection of the fact that we had prices falling out of bed in the year ago figure. In January 2015, we saw prices down over 1.5%, which is an all-time record low. In terms of growth, we haven't got our flash GDP figures yet for the Eurozone. They're not due out until the 12th of February, but the French data showed an increase of just 0.2% on a quarter-on-quarter basis, and within which, as we've been talking about previously, domestic demand remains crucially very sluggish. It was up just 0.1%. So, again, it's a case of overseas countries very much looking across to the United States to try and do some additional exporting to get their growth numbers going again. I round off here with the UK, where it's not really so much about the numbers as about the politics at the moment. We had a statement coming out from the European Commission President Donald Tusk early on today, really outlining a tentative agreement between the European Union and the UK regarding the UK's request for fairly substantial EU reform. Now, this is going to be part and parcel in terms of what we're going to do with regards to this EU referendum. If agreement on these details can be thrashed out the time we get into February EU Leaders Summit, and that's due to take place in the middle of February, chances are that we could see the referendum on whether or not the UK remains part of the European Union or opts to leave it taking place as early as June the 23rd. Now, at the moment, the opinion polls are extremely close, and it's really anyone's guess as to which way it's going to go. So that suggests we're in for a pretty volatile time for UK financial markets in terms of bonds, in terms of potentially equity markets, but also the pound as well, which has really come under the cosh in the course of the last month or so due to the way the Brexit polls have been narrowing, suggesting that we might be leaving the EU. For choice, I don't think we will do, but nonetheless, it's going to make for a pretty rocky time for the UK. A round off Bank of England on Thursday, no changes expected there. UK bank rate looks like it's going to be on hold indeed. I think any near-term moves more likely to be down than up. And the interesting part, there'll be whether or not the sole dissenter, Ian McCafferty, withdraws his current call for a hike in rates, because that's looking increasingly unlikely. Okay.
Anything else?
Well, I have one question. Jeremy, is there any impact from the immigration crisis in Europe? Any economic?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I think we're almost two schools of thought on this. I mean, on the positive side, the increase in the labour force could be seen as helping ultimately Eurozone productivity. On the other side of it, now those countries which are really having to absorb the bulk of the immigration, crucially Germany, are starting to struggle now actually to find positions for them. So it's become very much a political issue now. It's certainly one of the factors which is involved in terms of the EU negotiations with the UK. Prime Minister David Cameron here really is trying to put some stop onto immigration going into the UK, because we've had a disproportionate amount of it over the last several years now. But it's something which is an ongoing factor. It will start blowing up public sector deficits. It may help growth, but that's probably more of a long-term phenomenon. I think ultimately it's going to start to see Europe becoming more and more of a closed shop in terms of the European Union. And that at a time when it's supposed to be going in exactly the opposite direction in terms of free movement of trade and people and everything else. So it makes for quite an interesting time at the moment over here.
Are there any questions on taxation to pay for the immigration?
Well, there may well be at the moment. We haven't had too much really coming out from individual governments at the stage, because it's, say, politically, it's very much a hot potato. As far as Germany is concerned, they're basically saying, as things currently stand, they don't think of the implications for budget deficits or their own funding will be too bad, at least as far as this year is concerned. But were it to continue into 2017 and 18, then it may start having implications for what they've got to do with fiscal policy.
Thank you, gentlemen. And that'll be it for today. We look forward to continuing our conversation next Tuesday at the same time. Cheers.